The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man by James Weldon Johnson. Chapter 9. I did not feel at ease until the ship was well out of New York Harbor, and notwithstanding the repeated reassurances of my millionaire friend and my own knowledge of the facts in the case, I somehow could not rid myself of the sentiment that I was, in a great degree, responsible for the widow's tragic end. We had brought most of the morning papers aboard with us, but my great fear of seeing my name in connection with the killing would not permit me to read the accounts. Although in one of the papers I did look at the picture of the victim, which did not in the least resemble her. This morbid state of mind, together with seasickness, kept me miserable for 3 or 4 days. At the end of that time, my spirits began to revive, and I took an interest in the ship, my fellow passengers, and the voyage in general. On the second or third day out, we passed several spouting whales, but I could not arouse myself to make the effort to go to the other side of the ship to see them. A little later, we ran in close proximity to a large iceberg. I was curious enough to get up and look at it, and I was fully repaid for my pains. The sun was shining full upon it, and it glistened like a mammoth diamond, cut with a million facets. As we passed it, constantly changed its shapes. At each different angle of vision, it assumed new and astonishing forms of beauty. I watched it through a pair of glasses, seeking to verify my early conception of an iceberg. In the geographies of my grammar school days, the pictures of icebergs always included a stranded polar bear standing desolately upon one of the snowy crags. I looked for the bear, but if he was there, he refused to put himself on exhibition. It was not, however, until the morning that we entered the harbor of Havre that I was able to shake off my gloom. Then the strange sights, the chatter in an unfamiliar tongue, and the excitement of landing and passing the customs officials caused me to forget completely the events of a few days before. Indeed, I grew so light-hearted that when I caught my first sight of the train which was to take us to Paris, I enjoyed a hearty laugh. The toy-looking engine, the stuffy little compartment cars with tiny, old-fashioned wheels, struck me as being extremely funny. But before we reached Paris, my respect for our train rose considerably. I found that the tiny engine made remarkable fast time, and that the old-fashioned wheels ran very smoothly. I even began to appreciate the stuffy cars for their privacy. As I watched the passing scenery from the car window, it seemed too beautiful to be real. The bright-colored houses against the green background impressed me as the work of some idealistic painter. Before we arrived in Paris, there was awakened in my heart a love for France, which continued to grow stronger, a love which today makes that country for me the one above all others to be desired. We rolled into the station of Saint-Lazare about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and drove immediately to the Hotel Continental. My benefactor, humoring my curiosity and enthusiasm, which seemed to please him very much, suggested that we take a short walk before dinner. We stepped out of the hotel and turned to the right into the Rue de Rivoli. When the vista of the Palace de la Concorde and the Champs-Élysées suddenly burst on me, I could hardly credit my own eyes. I shall attempt no such superoratory task as a description of Paris. I wish only to give briefly the impressions which that wonderful city made upon me. It impressed me as the perfect and perfectly beautiful city. And even after I had been there for some time and seen not only its avenues and palaces, but its most squalid alleys and hovels, this impression was not weakened. Paris became for me a charmed spot, and whenever I have returned there, I have fallen under the spell, a spell which compels admiration for all of its manners and customs and justification of even its follies and sins. We walked a short distance up the Champs-Élysées and sat for a while in chairs along the sidewalk, watching the passing crowds on foot and in carriages. It was with reluctance that I went back to the hotel for dinner. After dinner, we went to one of the summer theaters, and after the performance, my friend took me to a large café on one of the grand boulevards. Here it was that I had my first glimpse of the French life of popular literature, so different from real French life. There were several hundred people, men and women, in the place, drinking, smoking, talking, and listening to the music. My millionaire friend and I took seats at a table where we sat smoking and watching the crowd. It was not long before we were joined by two or three good-looking, well-dressed young women. My friend talked to them in French and bought drinks for the whole party. I tried to recall my high school French, but the effort availed me little. I could stammer out a few phrases, but very naturally could not understand a word that was said to me. We stayed at the cafe a couple of hours, then went back to the hotel. The next day we spent several hours in the shops and at the tailor's. I had no clothes, except what I had been able to gather together at my benefactor's apartments the night before we sailed. He bought me the same kind of clothes which he himself wore, and that was the best. And he treated me in every way as he dressed me, as an equal, not as a servant. In fact, I don't think anyone could have guessed that such a relation existed. My duties were light and few, and he was a man full of life and vigor who rather enjoyed doing things for himself. He kept me supplied with money far beyond what ordinary wages would have amounted to. For the first 2 weeks, we were together almost constantly, seeing the sights old to him, but from which he seemed to get new pleasure in showing them to me. During the day, we took in the places of interest, and at night, the theaters and cafes. This sort of life appealed to me as ideal, and I asked him one day how long he intended to stay in Paris. He answered, "Oh, until I get tired of it." I could not understand how that could ever happen, as it was, including several short trips to the Mediterranean, to Spain, to Brussels, or to Ostend. We did remain there 14 or 15 months. We stayed at the Hotel Continental about 2 months of this time. Then my millionaire took apartments, hired a piano, and lived almost the same life he lived in New York. He entertained a great deal, some of the parties being a good deal more blasé than the New York ones. I played for the guests, and all of them with an effect which to relate would be but a tiresome repetition to the reader. I played not only for the guests, but continued, as I used to do in New York, to play often for the host when he was alone. This man of the world, who grew weary of everything and was always searching for something new, appeared never to grow tired of my music. He seemed to take it as a drug. He fell into a habit which caused me no little annoyance. Sometimes he would come in during the early hours of the morning and, finding me in bed asleep, would wake me up and ask me to play something. This, so far as I can remember, was my only hardship during my whole stay with him in Europe. After the first few weeks spent in sightseeing, I had a great deal of time left to myself. My friend was often I did not know where. When not with him, I spent the day nosing about all the curious nooks and corners of Paris. Of this, I never grew tired. At night, I usually went to some theater, but always ended up at the big café on the Grand Boulevards. I wished the reader to know that it was not alone the gaiety which drew me there. Aside from that, I had a laudable purpose. I had purchased an English-French conversational dictionary, and I went there every night to take a language lesson. I used to get three or four of the young women who frequented the place at a table and buy beer and cigarettes for them. In return, I received my lesson. I got more than my money's worth, for they actually compelled me to speak the language. This, together with the reading of the papers every day, enabled me within a few months to express myself fairly well and, before I left Paris, to have more than an ordinary command of French. Of course, every person who goes to Paris could not dare to learn French in this manner, but I can think of no easier or quicker way of doing it. The acquiring of another foreign language awoke me to the fact that with a little effort I could secure an added accomplishment as fine and as valuable as music. So I determined to make myself as much of a linguist as possible. I bought a Spanish newspaper every day in order to freshen my memory on that language, and for French, devise what was, so far as I knew, an original system of study. I compiled a list which I termed 300 necessary words. These I thoroughly committed to memory. Also, the conjugation of the verbs which were included in the list. I studied these words over and over, much like children of a couple of generations ago studied the alphabet. I also practiced a set of phrases like the following. How? What did you say? What does the word mean? I understand what you say, except... Please repeat. What do you call... How do you say... These I called my working sentences. In an astonishingly short time, I reached the point where the language taught itself, where I learned to speak merely by speaking. This point is the place which students taught foreign languages in our schools and colleges find great difficulty in reaching. I think the main trouble is that they learn too much of a language at a time. A French child with a vocabulary of 200 words can express more spoken ideas than a student of French can with a knowledge of a 2,000. A small vocabulary, the smaller the better, which embraces the common everyday used ideas, thoroughly mastered, is the key to a language. When that much is acquired, the vocabulary can be increased simply by talking, and it is easy. Who cannot commit 300 words to memory? Later, I tried my method, if I so may term it, with German, and found that it worked in the same way. I spent a good many evenings at the Grand Opera. The music there made me strangely reminiscent of my life in Connecticut. It was an atmosphere in which I caught a fresh breath of my boyhood days and early youth. Generally, in the morning, after I had attended a performance, I would sit at the piano and for a couple of hours play the music which I used to play in my mother's little parlor. One night, I went to hear Faust. I got into my seat just as the lights went down for the first act. At the end of the act one, I noticed that my neighbor on the left was a young girl. I cannot describe her either as to feature, color of her hair, or of her eyes. She was so young, so fair, so ethereal, that I felt to stare at her would be a violation, yet I was distinctly conscious of her beauty. During the intermission, she spoke English in a low voice to a gentleman and lady who sat in the seats to her left, addressing them as father and mother. I held my program as though studying it, but listened to each and every sound of her voice. Her observations on the performance and the audience were so fresh and naive as to be almost amusing. I gathered that she was just out of school and that this was her first trip to Paris. I occasionally stole a glance at her, and each time I did so, my heart leaped into my throat. Once I glanced beyond to the gentleman who sat next to her. My glance immediately turned into a stare. Yes, there he was. Unmistakably, my father. Looking hardly a day older than when I had seen him some 10 years before. What a strange coincidence. What should I say to him? What would he say to me? Before I had recovered from my first surprise, there came another shock and the realization that the beautiful, tender girl at my side was my sister. Then all the springs of affection in my heart, stopped since my mother's death, burst out in fresh and terrible torrents, and I could have fallen at her feet and worshipped her. They were singing the second act, but I did not hear the music. Slowly, the desolate loneliness of my position became clear to me. I knew that I could not speak, but I would have given a part of my life to touch her hand with mine and call her sister. I sat through the opera until I could stand it no longer. I felt that I was suffocating. Valentine's love seemed like mockery, and I felt an almost uncontrollable impulse to rise up and scream to the audience, "Here, here in your very midst is a tragedy, a real tragedy." This impulse grew so strong that I became afraid of myself, and in the darkness of one of the scenes, I stumbled out of the theater. I walked aimlessly about for an hour or so, my feelings divided between a desire to weep and a desire to curse. I finally took a cab and went from café to café, and for one of the very few times in my life, drank myself into a stupor. It was unwelcome news for me when my benefactor, I could not think of him as employer, informed me that he was at last tired of Paris. This news gave me, I think, a passing doubt as to his sanity. I had enjoyed life in Paris and, taking all things into consideration, enjoyed it wholesomely. One thing which greatly contributed to my enjoyment was the fact that I was an American. Americans are immensely popular in Paris, and this is not due solely to the fact that they spend lots of money there, for they spend just as much or more in London, and in the latter city they are merely tolerated because they do spend. The Londoner seems to think that Americans are people whose only claim to be classed as civilized is that they have money. And the regrettable thing about that is that the money is not English. But the French are more logical and freer from prejudices than the British, so the difference of attitude is easily explained. Only once in Paris did I have cause to blush for my American citizenship. I had become quite friendly with a young man from Luxembourg, whom I had met at the big café. He was a stolid, slow-witted fellow, but, as we say, with a heart of gold. He and I grew attached to each other and were together frequently. He was a great admirer of the United States and never grew tired of talking to me about the country and asking for information. It was his intention to try his fortune there some day. One night he asked me in a tone of voice which indicated that he expected an authoritative denial of an ugly rumor. Did they really burn a man alive in the United States? I never knew what I stammered out to him as an answer. I should have felt relieved if I could have even said to him, "Well, only one." When we arrived in London, my sadness at leaving Paris was turned into despair. After my long stay in the French capital, huge, ponderous, massive London seemed to me as ugly a thing as man could contrive to make. I thought of Paris as a beauty spot on the face of the earth, and of London as a big freckle. But soon London's massiveness, I might say its very ugliness, began to impress me. I began to experience that sense of grandeur which one feels when he looks at a great mountain or a mighty river. Beside London, Paris becomes a toy, a pretty plaything. And I must own that before I left the world's metropolis, I discovered much there that was beautiful. The beauty in and about London is entirely different from that in and about Paris. And I could not but admit that the beauty of the French city seemed handmade, artificial, as though set up for the photographer's camera. Everything nicely adjusted so as not to spoil the picture, while that of the English city was rugged, natural, and fresh. How these two cities typify the two peoples who built them. Even the sound of their names express a certain racial difference. Paris is the concrete expression of the gaiety, regard for symmetry, love of art, and, I might well add, of the morality of the French people. London stands for the conservatism, the solidarity, the utilitarianism, and I might well add the hypocrisy of the Anglo-Saxon. It may sound odd to speak of the morality of the French, if not of the hypocrisy of the English. But this seeming paradox impressed me as a deep truth. I saw many things in Paris which were immoral according to English standards, but the absence of hypocrisy, the absence of the spirit to do the right thing if it might only be done in secret, robed these very immoralities of the damning influence of the same evils in London. I have walked along the terrace cafes of Paris and seen hundreds of men and women sipping their wine and beer without observing a sign of drunkenness. As they drank, they chatted and laughed and watched the passing crowds. The drinking seemed to be a secondary thing. This I have witnessed not only in the cafes along the grand boulevards, but in the out-of-way places patronized by the working classes. In London, I have seen in the pubs men and women crowded in stuffy little compartments, drinking seemingly only for the pleasure of swallowing as much as they could hold. I have seen there women from 18 to 80, some in tatters and some clutching babies in their arms, drinking the heavy English ales and whiskies served to them by women. In the whole scene, not one ray of brightness, not one flash of gaiety, only maudlin joviality or grim despair. And I have thought, if some men and women will drink, and it is certain that some will, is it not better that they do so under the open sky in the fresh air than huddled together in some close, smoky room? There is a sort of frankness about the evils of Paris which robs them of much of the seductiveness of things forbidden, and with that frankness goes a certain cleanliness of thought belonging to things not hidden. London will do whatever Paris does, provided exterior morals are not shocked. As a result, Paris has the appearance only of being the more immoral city. The difference may be summed up in this. Paris practices its sins as lightly as it does its religion, while London practices both very seriously. I should not neglect to mention what impressed me most forcibly during my stay in London. It was not St. Paul's, nor the British Museum, nor Westminster Abbey. It was nothing more or less than the simple phrase, "Thank you," or sometimes more elaborated, "Thank you very kindly, sir." I was continually surprised by the varied uses, to which it was put. And, strange to say, its use as an expression of politeness seemed more limited than any other. One night I was in a cheap music hall and accidentally bumped into a waiter who was carrying a trayload of beer, almost bringing him to several shillings worth of grief. To my amazement, he righted himself and said, "Thank you, sir," and left me wondering whether he meant that he had thanked me for not completely spilling his beer, or that he would thank me for keeping out of his way. I also found cause to wonder upon what ground the English accuse Americans of corrupting the language by introducing slang words. I think I heard more and more different kinds of slang during my few weeks in London than in my whole tenderloin life in New York. But I suppose the English feel that the language is theirs and that they may do with it as they please without at the same time allowing that privilege to others. My millionaire was not so long in growing tired of London as of Paris. After a stay of 6 or 8 weeks, we went across into Holland. Amsterdam was a great surprise to me. I'd always thought of Venice as the city of canals, but it had never entered my mind that I should find similar conditions in a Dutch town. I don't suppose the comparison goes far beyond the fact that there are canals in both cities. I've never seen Venice, but Amsterdam struck me as being extremely picturesque. From Holland, we went to Germany, where we spent 5 or 6 months, most of the time in Berlin. I found Berlin more to my taste than London, and occasionally I had to admit that in some things it was superior to Paris. In Berlin, I especially enjoyed the orchestral concerts, and I attended a large number of them. I formed the acquaintance of a good many musicians, several of whom spoke of my playing in high terms. It was in Berlin that my inspiration was renewed. One night, my millionaire entertained a party of men composed of artists, musicians, writers, and, for aught I know, a count or two. They drank and smoked a great deal, talked art and music, and discussed, it seemed to me, everything that had ever entered man's mind. I could only follow the general drift of what they were saying. When they discussed music, it was more interesting to me, for then some fellow would turn excitedly to the piano and give a demonstration of his opinions, and another would follow, quickly doing the same. In this way, I learned that regardless of what his specialty might be, every man in the party was a musician. I was at the same time impressed with the falsity of the general idea that Frenchmen are excitable and emotional, and that Germans are calm and phlegmatic. Frenchmen are merely gay and never overwhelmed by their emotions. When they talk loud and fast, it's merely talk, while Germans get worked up and red in the face when sustaining an opinion, and in heated discussions are likely to allow their emotions to sweep them off their feet. My millionaire planned in the midst of the discussion on the music to have me play the new American music and astonish everybody present. The result was that I was more astonished than anyone else. I went to the piano and played the most intricate ragtime piece I knew. Before there was time for anybody to express an opinion on what I had done, a big, bespectacled, bushy-headed man rushed over and, shoving me out of the chair, exclaimed, "Get up! Get up!" He seated himself at the piano and, taking the theme of my ragtime, played it through first in straight chords, then varied and developed it through every known musical form. I sat amazed. I had been turning classic music into ragtime, a comparatively easy task, and this man had taken ragtime and made it classic. The thought came across me like a flash. It can be done. Why can't I do it? From that moment, my mind was made up. I clearly saw the way of carrying out the ambition I had formed when a boy. I now lost interest in our trip. I thought, here I am, a man, no longer a boy, and what am I doing but wasting my time and abusing my talent? What use am I making of my gifts? What future have I before me, following my present course? These thoughts made me feel remorseful and put me in a fever to get to work, to begin to do something. Of course, I know now that I was not wasting time, that there was nothing I could have done at that age which would have benefited more than going to Europe as I did. The desire to begin work grew stronger each day, and I could think of nothing else. I made up my mind to go back into the very heart of the South, to live among the people and drink in my inspiration firsthand. I gloated over the immense amount of material I had to work with, not only modern ragtime, but also the old slave songs, material which no one had yet touched. The more decided and anxious I became to return to the United States, the more I dreaded the ordeal of breaking with my millionaire. Between this peculiar man and me, there had grown a very strong bond of affection, backed up by a debt which each owed to the other. He had taken me from a terrible life in New York and given me the opportunity of traveling and of coming in contact with the people with whom he was associated, had made me a polished man of the world. On the other hand, I was his chief means of disposing of the thing which seemed to sum up all in life that he dreaded, time. As I remember him now, I can see that time was what he was always endeavoring to escape, to bridge over, to blot out. And it is not strange that some years later he did escape it forever, by leaping into eternity. For some weeks, I waited for just the right moment in which to tell my patron of my decision. Those weeks were a trying time to me. I felt that I was playing the part of a traitor to my best friend. At length, one day he said to me, "Well, get ready for a long trip. We're going to Egypt and then to Japan." The temptation was, for an instant, almost overwhelming, but I summoned determination enough to say, "I don't think I want to go." "What?" he exclaimed. "You want to go back to your dear Paris? You still think that's the only spot on earth? Wait till you see Cairo and Tokyo. You may change your mind." "No," I stammered. "It is not because I want to go back to Paris. I want to go back to the United States." He wished to know my reason, and I told him as best I could my dreams, my ambition, and my decision. While I was talking, he watched me with a curious, almost cynical smile growing on his lips. When I had finished, he put his hand on my shoulder. This was the first physical expression of tender regard he had ever shown me. And looking at me in a big, brotherly way, he said, "My boy, you are by blood, by appearance, by education, and by tastes, a white man. Now why do you want to throw your life away amidst the poverty and ignorance in the hopeless struggle of the black people of the United States? Then look at the terrible handicap you are placing on yourself by going home and working as a Negro composer. You can never be able to get the hearing of your work which it might deserve. I doubt that even a white musician of recognized ability could succeed by working on the theory that American music should be based on Negro themes. Music is a universal art. Anybody's music belongs to everybody. You can't limit it to race or country. Now, if you want to become a composer, why not stay right here in Europe? I will put you under the best teachers on the continent. Then if you want to write music on Negro themes, why, go ahead and do it." We talked for some time on music and the race question. On the latter subject, I had never before heard him express any opinion. Between him and me, no suggestion of racial differences had ever come up. I found that he was a man entirely free from prejudice, but he recognized that prejudice was a big, stubborn entity which had to be taken into account. He went on to say, "This idea you have of making a Negro out of yourself is nothing more than a sentiment, and you do not realize the fearful import of what you intend to do. What kind of a Negro would you make now, especially in the South? If you had remained there, or perhaps even in your club in New York, you might have succeeded very well, but now you would be miserable. I can imagine no more dissatisfied human being than an educated, cultured, and refined colored man in the United States. I have given more study to the race question in the United States than you may suppose, and I sympathize with the Negroes there. But what's the use? I can't right their wrongs, and neither can you. They must do that themselves. They are unfortunate in having wrongs to right, and you would be foolish to unnecessarily take their wrongs on your shoulders. Perhaps some day, through study and observation, you will come to see that evil is a force, and like the physical and chemical forces, we cannot annihilate it. We may only change its form. We light upon one evil and hit it with all the might of our civilization, but only succeed in scattering it into a dozen other forms. We hit slavery through a great civil war. Did we destroy it? No. We only changed it into a hatred between sections of the country. In the South, into political corruption and chicanery, the degradation of the blacks through peonage, unjust laws, unfair and cruel treatment, and the degradation of the whites by their resorting to these practices. The paralyzation of the public conscience and the ever-overhanging dread of what the future may bring. Modern civilization hid ignorance on the masses through the means of popular education. What has it done to turn ignorance into anarchy, socialism, strikes, hatred between poor and rich, and universal discontent? In like manner, modern philanthropy hit at suffering and disease through asylums and hospitals. It prolongs the sufferers' lives, it is true, but is at the same time sending down strains of insanity and weakness into future generations. My philosophy of life is this: make yourself as happy as possible, and try to make those happy whose lives come into touch with yours. But to attempt to right the wrongs that ease the sufferings of the world in general is a waste of effort. You had just as well tried to bail the Atlantic by pouring the water into the Pacific. This tremendous flow of serious talk from a man I was accustomed to see either gay or taciturn so surprised and overwhelmed me that I could not frame a reply. He left me thinking over what he had said. Whatever was the soundness of his logic or the moral tone of his philosophy, his argument greatly impressed me. I could see, in spite of the absolute selfishness upon which it was based, that there was reason and common sense in it. I began to analyze my own motives and found that they, too, were very largely mixed with selfishness. Was it more a desire to help those I considered my people, or more a desire to distinguish myself, which was leading me back to the United States? That is a question I have never definitively answered. For several weeks longer, I was in a troubled state of mind. Added to the fact that I was loath to leave my good friend was the weight of the question he had aroused in my mind, whether I was not making a fatal mistake. I suffered more than one sleepless night during that time. Finally, I settled the question on purely selfish grounds, in accordance with my millionaire's philosophy. I argued that music offered me a better future than anything else I had any knowledge of, and in opposition to my friend's opinion, that I should have greater chances of attracting attention as a colored composer than as a white one. But I must own that I also felt stirred by an unselfish desire to voice all the joys and sorrows, the hopes and ambitions of the American Negro, in classic musical form. When my mind was fully made up, I told my friend. He asked me when I intended to start. I replied that I would do so at once. He then asked me how much money I had. I told him that I had saved several $100 out of sums he had given me. He gave me a check for $500 and told me to write to him, care of his Paris bankers, if I ever needed his help, wished me good luck, and bade me goodbye. All this he did almost coldly, and I often wondered whether he was in a hurry to get rid of what he considered a fool, or whether he was striving to hide deeper feelings of sorrow. And so I separated from a man who was, all in all, the best friend I ever had, except my mother, the man who exerted the greatest influence ever brought into my life, except that exerted by my mother. My affection for him was so strong, my recollections of him are so distinct, he was such a peculiar and striking character, that I could easily fill several chapters with reminiscences of him. But for fear of tiring the reader, I shall go on with my narration. I decided to go to Liverpool and take ship for Boston. I still had an uneasy feeling about returning to New York, and in a few days I found myself aboard a ship headed for home. End of chapter. Read by Jorge Acosta for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.